KBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The National Weather Service says the deadly storms that swept through the South Friday included at least 10 tornadoes that touched down in Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee. 25 people were killed, most of them in Mississippi, where whole towns have been destroyed. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell is making her way to Mississippi after President Biden issued a disaster declaration. She tells ABC's This Week.
The biggest priority for me is, one, making sure that the local jurisdictions, those first responders, have all of the resources that they need. And then second, that we start to take care of these families.
More severe weather in the forecast today. Multiple tornadoes spotted in Georgia. Ukraine's calling for a UN Security Council meeting after Russia said it's going to station tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus. Senior U.S. official says there are no indications Russia plans to use nuclear weapons. Authorities in West Reading, Pennsylvania, say the death toll from the explosion at a chocolate factory Friday's climbed to 4. 3 people are still unaccounted for. This is ABC News. Authorities in Pennsylvania say 4 people are still unaccounted for after the explosion Friday at a chocolate factory in West Reading that killed 3 people. Cause is still under investigation. President Biden's choice to run the Federal Aviation Administration has withdrawn his name from consideration.
Phil Washington is the current CEO of Denver International Airport and has taken himself out of the running to lead the FAA, as it appeared he lacked enough support in the closely divided Senate to be confirmed. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, in a tweet, blaming it on what he called undeserved partisan attacks. Republicans were united in their opposition of Washington, calling him unqualified because of limited aviation experience. Democrats may have been able to push his nomination through, but some key senators expressed reservations. Mark Remillard, ABC News.
Last two spots in college basketball's men's Final Four up for grabs today. Creighton plays San Diego State, then it's Miami and Texas. Florida Atlantic and Connecticut clinch their spots in Houston on Saturday. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Kids, they're just different than us. They have no inhibitions, consider silverware optional, and can find fun anywhere. And when kids get really sick, they're different than us too. Until now, children diagnosed with blood cancer have been treated like many adults. Not anymore. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society proudly introduces the Dare to Dream Project, transforming treatment and care through advocacy, education, and the largest global clinical trial for kids with blood cancer. For the first time, a specific treatment can be matched to a specific type of cancer in a specific child. It'll be the biggest medical advancement for little patients in history. Dare to dream with us. Support the Dare to Dream Project and all the work that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does at lls.org.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Krebscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. President Biden wants to raise taxes on Americans earning more than $400,000 a year. The rate would go from the current 3.8% to 5%. The new revenue would be used to shore up Medicare. Some of the biggest supporters of the bill are those who would get taxed the most. More from Eric Galatis.
Morris Pearl with the group Patriotic Millionaire says there's more than enough money to fund Medicare. He argues the wealthiest Americans, especially those living off of their investments, can and should be paying more.
We can ask the financially challenged people who need Medicare to sacrifice more by having less medical care, or we can ask the ultra-rich to sacrifice more by being a little bit less ultra-rich.
Biden's proposal would keep Medicare solvent for at least the next 25 years, according to estimates by the Medicare Office of the Chief Actuary. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has promised it will not advance in Congress. Critics say raising taxes would hurt the economy. They argue that people would spend less if their earnings drop. Pearl agrees that the economy depends on consumer spending and says working Americans who spend most of what they bring home should be allowed to keep more of their money.
The very rich people are not going to spend more money. They'll just become a little bit richer.
More than 65 million people across the U.S. depend on Medicare coverage, but the fund's trustees warn that cuts to benefits will be necessary by 2028 without increased revenues. Pearl notes that the nation's economy was strong under the Republican Eisenhower administration, when the wealthiest Americans paid tax rates up to 90% on their second, third, and fourth millions.
And there's no reason why people who make a lot of money now should be paying not the same tax rate people who work for a living, but actually lower tax rates. We need to change the system.
This is Eric Gladys reporting.
And you're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Dear hero, whoever you are, you save lives. I live with sickle cell and the pain and the issues that come along with sickle cell every day. I've had lots and lots of blood transfusions over my lifetime, probably in the hundreds. Blood helps me to be able to live.
My final tour was in Afghanistan in 2008. I was hit June 3rd. The next thing I remember, I woke up in Germany. The doctor came in and said, "We're going to amputate your leg." I had to get a lot of blood transfusion to stay alive.
Because of you, I'm allowed to see my son grow up.
Because of you, I got a second chance at life.
Giving equals living. Give blood. Replenish the supply. Make an appointment to give today by visiting hhs.gov/giveblood. This message is brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
We are back in this second hour of Morning Cannolis here, a broadcast of Civic Media in southeastern Wisconsin. But throughout the state of Wisconsin, we're coming to you this morning, of course, from our studios in WAUK, downtown Waukesha. Beautiful, snowy downtown Waukesha. Nonetheless, inviting every single Saturday morning your questions, your comments, your perspectives on things that we talk about here related to government, the rule of law, the aspiration for justice in America, and my producer Anya and I taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789 throughout this second hour of our broadcast on Saturday, March 25th. Thank you once again for joining me, bringing me into your homes, your businesses, your cars as you make your way away around on this Saturday morning. We're providing an awful lot of information, updates about what's going on with major investigations, focusing upon the conduct, recent and perhaps not so recent, of our former President Donald Trump. And right before the break, talking about not only these grand jury investigations focusing on Mar-a-Lago, the classified documents in his possession illegally at that Mar-a-Lago location, but also this major investigation, again, being handled by Jack Smith, a federal investigation, the grand jury meeting repeatedly many, many days to determine whether or not there is probable cause to believe that the president and perhaps others in his senior circle were responsible for violating federal law in connection with the attempt to overthrow our government, our process, before, during, and after January 6th. We'll be plainly monitoring that down the road, getting back on this broadcast and in others as any of those grand juries return charges. Up to this point, have not done so. Their investigations presumably continue. Right before the break, we were talking about investigations now completed and indeed trials in the wake of a grand jury investigation and indictment. In particular, this fact that just on Monday of this past week, four additional members of the Oath Keepers, this is this militia group that went into the Capitol on January 6th, four additional members convicted of conspiracy to obstruct the work of Congress. This prosecution, this trial result, bringing to an end the third and final trial that examines the role of this militia group, this far-right group that they played in the attack of January 6th. These verdicts handed up after more than a week of deliberations by a trial jury, by called a petit jury in the federal district court, in a public proceeding in Washington, followed, as you may recall, the convictions previously in two separate trials. A fellow named Stuart Rhodes, he is the leader of the Oath Keepers, and five other members of that group on charges of what? seditious conspiracy, this major significant charge against them, most significant count to have been brought so far against any of the about 1,000 people were arrested in connection with the Capitol attack of January 6th. So again, this brings to an end these trials, does not bring to an end the proceedings themselves. Plainly, all of these defendants have the right, as many of them are doing, to pursue these matters on appeal. Those cases would go where? To the United States Circuit Court in the District of Columbia Circuit for review, not a new trial, but a review of whether there were any errors that were committed in any of these trials. The results this past week, these additional convictions coming up again, presumably sentences down the road, bring to a head some convictions of 15 members of this group altogether. And it really has had the impact of crippling this organization that was once at its height, tens of thousands of adherents and individuals around the country, these self-appointed vigilantes, if you will, on this mission for over a decade in cities across the country to undermine who we are as a nation, now effectively all convicted of federal crimes related to January 6th and moving forward. We know as well that even as that Oath Keepers set of prosecutions approaches an end with upcoming sentences of these additional people, we know that the parallel in prosecution of the Proud Boys, this other somewhat related organization, the same kind of thing, their trial continues also in the Federal District Court, that same courthouse in Washington, D.C. This major related federal case against these militant groups, group members, the Proud Boys, again, related to their January 6th involvement in the uprising, brought again by the U.S. Department of Justice, based upon this belief that the leaders of the Proud Boys and others, specifically a fellow named Enrique Tarrio and four of his lieutenants, engaged again in seditious conspiracy, the same thing charged against the leaders of the Oath Keepers, the other group out there. Prosecutors have characterized, like the Oath Keepers, they've characterized the Proud Boys as perpetrating a very sophisticated plot to essentially overthrow the U.S. government by halting the transfer of power from Donald Trump to President Joe Biden. As a result of that activity, again, grand jury indictments returned against Enrique Tarrio, now the subject of continuing trials. That planning, the presentation of those trials involved, among other things, this battle-like campaign that we've heard evidence of in these trials to attack the Capitol in these teams. They were prepared, apparently, to expand the fight throughout other federal buildings in Washington, D.C., to effectively seize control of the government at that time. The defense, in fairness, has claimed that these Proud Boys are a little more than a glorified drinking club, belied by this very compelling set of evidence we have seen in the trials, and that members had no plans to storm the Capitol or stop President Biden from taking the oath of office, becoming president as he did. So that is a part of the trial proceedings. Again, we hasten to add that all defendants in our good nation, our wonderful nation, a nation of the rule of law, are presumed innocent until they are proven guilty. That presumption of innocence no longer attends all of those 15 members of the Oath Keepers group. They are now convicted, and we have found by a compelling evidence, but beyond a reasonable doubt, that all of those folks did in fact engage in seditious conspiracy or a conspiracy to obstruct the work of Congress on, before, and after January 6th. Why is all this important? I always ask that question. The answer is that we have got now findings, again in grand juries, but now with respect to the Oath Keepers and presumably down the road, with respect to the Proud Boys too, we have got individuals like all of you called in to be members of petit or trial juries, looking at all this evidence and assessing this based upon what is presented as evidence, documents certainly, videos, lots of those related to January 6th, testimony by people who have pled guilty, people who have been implanted, if you will, inside these seditious groups to come in and testify about what their purpose was. Evidence presented to members of the citizenry. They're members of the trial jury. And what have they found? Independent of politics, independent of what Republicans say, what Democrats say, they have found beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimously, that these people have engaged in exactly what they've been charged with, which is seditious conspiracy. That should be the great message going forward. Plainly, a message with respect to these defendants going to spend some time, significant time, in prison as a result of what they have done, deterring them in particular for what they have done, but also deterring other people who would think in the future, in the present, about possibly engaging in similar conspiratorial conduct, sedition against the government. Maybe you should think twice, three times, four times about that. That's the general deterrence about which we've talked a lot on this program. And beyond those messages to these particular defendants who attempted to undermine our government, the very nature of our republic, beyond that, also this important message to, yes, our politicians who maintain that what happened on January 6th was simply a legitimate political discourse, tourists coming in and out of the Capitol building, nothing of the sort. No support for that whatsoever. Why? Because we now have an independent, apolitical, nonpartisan assessment, judgments made by people listening to the evidence impartially, based upon jury instructions given them, based upon evidentiary rulings made by the trial judges, and coming to the conclusion these trial juries have that there is indeed proof beyond a reasonable doubt that this happened, that the purpose of their activity was to undermine the government, to engage in the very sedition with which they have been charged, putting an end, should put to an end, although plainly it doesn't, regrettably, those people who even just this past week continue to say that January 6th was not the insurrection that it was. We know just the opposite, based not only upon the evidence, but upon the finding of people independent who looked at all this and said, this was sedition, this was conspiracy to undermine and overthrow our republic. We also know just this past week that among that 1,000 or so people I mentioned before were also been charged and in many ways moving toward trial, many of them convicted, somewhere approaching 500 of those 1,000 people or more convicted or charged rather with involvement, specific involvement in the assault on our Capitol on January 6th. Just this past week, additional sentences being doled out with respect to these people. There are a lot of them happening every single week. Again, this going on in the wake of either plea agreements by these defendants previously charged with conduct, invading the Capitol, undermining the process, obstructing the course of Congress in voting on the Electoral College ballots that are coming in. Some of them engaged in activities that are also very violent on that day. Many of them are pleading guilty to those counts or some variation on those accounts, some of them going to trial, and virtually all of them being found guilty once again by trial juries looking at the evidence of their involvement in the January 6th insurrection, and ultimately resulting in, as we saw this past week, sentences in the wake of those convictions by the trial juries of the imposition of sentences upon them. Let's talk about just three of them to give you some sampling of what is happening this week, every single day almost these days, with respect to these 400, almost 500 now people found guilty, presumably the great majority of the remaining 500 also facing similar fates. Well, what do we know about three of them? Just three as a sampling of what's going on today in America. Judge Amit Mehta. Again, we have heard from him in the past. He and his colleagues handle a lot of these cases. Since a fellow named Mitchell Todd Gardner, 34, he comes from Florida, a place called Sefner, Florida, to 55 months in federal prison. Just happened on Friday. Again, this proceeding in the District of Columbia trial court. Mehta also ordered Gardner to pay $3,500 in restitution, plainly for some of the damage that he caused, and to stay under supervised release for 36 months after he leaves prison. Right after the break, I'm going to tell you more about Mr. Gardner and two other defendants who likewise saw the results of their activity, their criminal conduct in federal court in Washington, D.C. just this past week. Everybody.
kids. They're just different than us. They have no inhibitions, consider silverware optional, and can find fun anywhere. And when kids get really sick, they're different than us too. Until now, children diagnosed with blood cancer have been treated like many adults. Not anymore. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society proudly introduces the Dare to Dream Project, transforming treatment and care through advocacy, education, and the largest global clinical trial for kids with blood cancer. For the first time, a specific treatment can be matched to a specific type of cancer in a specific child. It'll be the biggest medical advancement for little patients in history. Dare to dream with us. Support the Dare to Dream Project and all the work that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does at lls.org.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold. 1993 to 1999 and again 2001 to 2003. 125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football. You're about to find out. Under the Helmet with the Grave Digger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast. A mix of clouds and sun this afternoon, with daytime highs approaching 41. Winds out of the northwest, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Partly cloudy skies again tonight, lows dip down to about 22. Highs around 39. Tomorrow, sunshine mixed with clouds at times. Sunshine mixed with clouds at times Tuesday, with daytime highs approaching 42. 35, chance for snow Wednesday. A dusting of snow Tuesday night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Ray Miller. Right now, it's 34.
This is Civic Media for the Fox Valley.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Morning Cannolis, our weekly discussion of news in the areas of government and law and the aspiration for justice in America. As always, here with you in the studios of WAUK Radio in Waukesha, but broadcasting through Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin. My producer this morning, Anya, and I taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Looking forward to your perspectives as always. Right before the break, talking about what happens. What happens to these now approaching 500 defendants who have been convicted of engaging in an assault upon the Capitol on January 6th? In particular, this one defendant, Michael Todd Gardner, sentenced to 55 months. That's basically about 4.5 years in federal prison. No parole in federal prison these days. Also some period of time, about 36 months, 3 years of supervised release. And ordered to pay $3,500 in restitution by Judge Mehta, who imposed the sentence upon him. Where does that come from? What did Michael Todd Gardner do on January 6th? Well, it turns out that he pepper sprayed Capitol Police. And he also broke smashed a window to the tune of $2,900. Pepper spraying police. So this was someone who's involved in a confrontation with the police. Prosecutors charged him, of course, with obstructing official proceeding, entering, remaining in the building without authorization, and importantly, assaulting, resisting, impeding officers with a dangerous weapon. Yes, that's that pepper spray. Significantly, attorneys for Gardner during the course of the sentencing proceeding, and yes, in all sentencings, the defendant has a right to what's called allocution, could talk about the reasons why he or she engaged in the conduct. Prosecutors have the option and always do talk about the nature of the conduct itself. The attorneys for Gardner during the course of his sentencing just this past week said in a sentencing memorandum that Gardner grew up in a red state, they said, which explains, as they described it, the huge discrepancy between his life and the nonviolent choices he was previously making and his behavior on the day of January 6th. Significantly, Gardner's attorneys said that Gardner had voted for President Obama both times and did not vote for Donald Trump when he ran for office. Again, exercise of the franchise, appropriately to do that. Bottom line is, we do not convict people for voting. We do just the opposite. We encourage that in America, whatever your choice is, however your selection goes. What we do not do is we do not condone violence And indeed, Mr. Gardner this past week found that out as he goes to federal prison for 3 years. Let's talk about a couple others just to give you some sampling of what continues to happen in the wake of what was indeed an insurrection in America in 2021 January. During the course of yet another sentencing this past week, this one involved in front of John Bates, who is a U.S. District Court judge. Likewise, he is assigned to oversee the prosecution, the trial, the conviction, and now the sentencing of a fellow named Larry Brock. Larry Brock. What did Mr. Brock do? Well, he entered the Capitol building and was seen with zip-tie handcuffs on the Senate floor. The judge, again, Judge Bates, for entering the building, this Air Force veteran, a previous veteran in our military, entered the Senate chamber on January 6th, sentenced to 2 years in prison, 2 years in federal prison for doing that. And as a result of that, he will spend that time. Mr. Brock, as I said, was a 55-year-old retired lieutenant colonel. He had joined on January 6th with other rioters on the Senate floor only minutes after some security rushed the vice president, Mike Pence, out of that chamber and away from the mob. And, of course, we've seen the videos of that particular event. Significantly, in his explanation of the sentence that he was imposing, Judge John Bates, again, imposing this sentence upon Larry Brock for his being there, having these zip ties. What are zip ties? Why does he have them there? Plainly to restrain people, right? To bring them into custody completely, completely illegally, violating the civil rights, the human rights of other people. That's plainly what he intended, or at least prepared to do. What does John Bates, the district court judge, say about all this? He says, he describes it in these very, very harsh terms. He says, it's really pretty astounding coming from a former high-ranked military officer. Your behavior is astounding and atrocious. Interestingly, under the sentencing guidelines, that same judge lowered the federal sentencing range from 57 to 71 months to 24 to 30 months, given the dynamics of this particular case, including he gave him some consideration for being in the military service and the lack of a prior criminal record. Again, brings to this no prior criminal record, so his exposure somewhat limited. But the judge did say that he took into account the extreme rhetoric found on Brock's Facebook pages, which he read aloud in court when determining the sentence. In one of those Facebook posts that the judge read out loud, the defendant spoke of a civil war after Trump's electoral loss. He said, I think it's fair to say that his rhetoric is at the far end of how extreme it is. That's the judge commenting on the things that he is reciting from the Facebook page of this defendant. The defendant goes on to say in those same Facebook page postings, we need to execute the traitors that are trying to steal the election. And that includes the leaders of the media and social media aiding and abetting the coup plotters. Brock wrote that on his social media platform in November of 2020, at about the time following the election of 2020. Goes on to say, no way should we accept this rigged election. I think SCOTUS, that is the Supreme Court of the United States, needs to see if they don't act that there will be blood. And post written on Christmas Eve, Brock also said, I bought myself body armor and a helmet for the civil war that is coming. Well, sentenced this past week, once again, to that term of imprisonment, Larry Brock sentenced to 2 years in prison for his involvement in entering and, plainly, his intent to engage in that kind of behavior. And finally, let's talk about a young person who was convicted and sentenced. We're going to talk about a sentence imposed by Judge Reggie Walton upon Aiden Billiard right after this break.
The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24-7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. The death toll from a tornado Friday in Mississippi is now 25. Fox Valley, regional and state news and commentary for us to find common ground. Civic Media.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The National Weather Service says the deadly storms that swept through the South Friday included at least 10 tornadoes that touched down in Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee. 25 people were killed, most of them in Mississippi, where whole towns have been destroyed. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell is making her way to Mississippi after President Biden issued a disaster declaration. She tells ABC's This Week.
The biggest priority for me is, one, making sure that the local jurisdictions, those first responders, have all of the resources that they need. And then second, that we start to take care of these families.
More severe weather in the forecast today. Multiple tornadoes spotted in Georgia. Ukraine's calling for a UN Security Council meeting after Russia said it's going to station tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus. Senior U.S. official says there are no indications Russia plans to use nuclear weapons. Authorities in West Reading, Pennsylvania, say the death toll from the explosion at a chocolate factory Friday's climbed to 4. 3 people are still unaccounted for. This is ABC News.
The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens, and I'll tell you what, it's more fun than tipping cows. And actually, you shouldn't really tip the cows, okay? They don't tip as easy as they think, and they might kick you in the... Never mind.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Unemployment in Wisconsin is at a record low, 2.7%. That's down from 2.9% in January. The Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development says the number of people looking for work in the state dropped to 82,900, which is also a record low. Almost 3 million people are working in Wisconsin. That's a record high. Governor Evers' proposed budget would lead to an overall increase in taxes and fees. The nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau says the net increase would add up to more than $108 million. WisPolitics.com reports the proposed tax increases would overshadow the tax cuts in Evers' budget. Majority Republicans are working on their own budget. In sports, the Bucks are at Utah tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Dear hero, whoever you are, you save lives. I live with sickle cell and the pain and the issues that come along with sickle cell every day. I've had lots and lots of blood transfusions over my lifetime, probably in the hundreds. Blood helps me to be able to live.
My final tour was in Afghanistan in 2008. I was hit June 3rd. The next thing I remember, I woke up in Germany. The doctor came in and said, we're going to amputate your leg. I had to get a lot of blood transfusion to stay alive.
Because of you, I'm allowed to see my son grow up.
Because of you, I got a second chance at life.
Giving equals living. Give blood. Replenish the supply. Make an appointment to give today by visiting hhs.gov/giveblood. This message is brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
You were supposed to get a colon cancer screening, but stuff came up.
We did have to pick up the twins from practice.
But on the way, we hit a giant pothole.
If you are 45 and older, don't let stuff get in the way of your screening. Visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at ccalliance.org.
But then...
6th Insurrection, giving you a sampling this morning of what continues to happen in the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. with respect to something approaching 500 defendants who were involved in the assault, the attack on our Capitol on January 6th. About 500 more waiting for the disposition of their cases, either through plea agreements or trials and sentencings, underscoring this notion that those politicians, those members of our public who would say out there that the January 6th event was nothing more than a civics exercise, a visitation by people to our Capitol, a legitimate political discourse, all of that completely wrong, and refuted by what is going on in our federal courts today. Talked before the break about a couple of the sentences imposed. tragically upon people who became involved in this insurrection attempt. Here's a third one. This one involves a 21-year-old. He was 18. He was 18 at the time of the January 6, 2021 insurrection. The defendant, his name is Aidan Billiard, B-I-L-Y-A-R-D, sentenced to 40 months in prison. 40 months in prison for his involvement in the January 6th event. He appears before yet another federal district court judge. That judge named Reggie Walton, again, a federal district court judge appointed by a former president serving lifetime tenure, required to, as a part of his assignment, like the other judges, adjudicate through trial, through disposition, through judgment, and impose sentence upon those people who are found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt for their involvement in this kind of activity. Billiard himself entered a plea agreement with the prosecution after he admitted in October to assaulting a police officer with a deadly or dangerous weapon when he sprayed Capitol officers with a pepper gel. And at the time, he faced 46 to 57 months in prison. Again, another instance of spraying, assaulting, attacking a police officer there. Significantly, his mother, Amy Billiard, told the judge when the imposition of sentence was announced here, that she said, "That's not right." And the mother, of course, responding badly to what she is seeing her son being exposed to. Judge Walton answered her from the bench and said, "You make your bed, you've got to lie in it." To which Ms. Billiard amazingly, stunningly responded even further, "He's lied in it." Well, it turns out that what Mr. Billiard did, even at the young age of 18, was quite graphic and quite destructive of not only that day in our Capitol, but again, this assault, spraying chemicals at the police. Billiard was actually captured on surveillance with this home defense pepper gel in his presence, and the Lower West Terrace. I suspect many of you have been to the Capitol. The video takes him at that location. And after doing that, after being a part of this process, this unconstitutional attempt to overthrow our government, this illegal criminal activity, he drives back to his hometown in North Carolina that very night. Okay, the FBI then identifies him again through some of these videotapes. And initially in 2021, he denies taking part in the insurrection, despite being confronted with this video evidence. Arrested later that year, while he's on basic training, he enters the military in Texas and later dismissed by the Air Force for his involvement. Again, the point of all that, bringing to a conclusion what could have been a productive entry, a service to America through the United States military, brought short as a result of this activity, this event he engages in. Billiard's attorneys at the time of the sentencing this past week asked the judge for home detention and 5 years of probation. They argue that Billiard was young, impressionable, and that he took part in the January 6th riots because he was brought there, basically indoctrinated by others. And the judge says this, rejecting that concept. He says, 18 is old enough to know right from wrong. To see this kind of evidence, police fighting for their lives, yet you don't get to the mindset at some point that this is wrong and I've got to stop. It is just something that is chilling and is beyond the pale. Again, those are the statements of the sentencing judge during the course of this proceeding of just this past week. Again, defense attorneys coming forward saying that he was the subject of other rioters who motivated him to join in this insurrection. Ms. Billiard, his mother, said his son was an intelligent, warm, and kind boy whose role in the riot was an exception to the way that he had been raised. And all of that may well be true. And the judge talked about that during the course of the sentencing of this past week. Nonetheless, this 21-year-old now in federal prison based upon his involvement of that time, January 6th, joining the others, about the 500, 400, 500 others, also the subject of these prosecutions. All of that we've talked about up to this point, all that criminal in nature, I want to get back to and update you on something else in the civil arena, the non-criminal arena that we've also talked about. It goes back once again to not so much January 6th, but focus upon the former president. You may recall as well that in addition to Alvin Bragg, who again is pondering through the grand jury the imposition of some charges, criminal charges under state New York law against the former president having to do with this hush money situation. We know that right across Foley Square, other offices in New York, Letitia James, who is the attorney general of the state of New York, she has civil responsibility. She's got civil jurisdiction, not criminal jurisdiction, but civil jurisdiction to review matters. And sure enough, you may recall a number of months ago, she brought a civil case in New York State Court proposing to find that the Trump organizations and the Trump players themselves, including the former president and his children, have engaged in civil fraud, have basically filed statements of financial condition, have valued properties at various levels that are inconsistent with prior statements made about those properties, and plainly are false statements. All those according to the allegations of Letitia James in this civil lawsuit alleging fraud against the former president, his children, also seeking to have them prohibited in the future from ever engaging in corporate activities in the state of New York. She's seeking $250 million against them for these engagements in civil fraud activities, violations of the valuations of property under New York law. Well, this past week, Judge Arthur Engoron, from whom we have also heard before, had before him a request to postpone the trial in this matter, the civil trial, the civil jury trial, again, in a New York courtroom before a civil jury, had a request from the defendant, the folks who are on the receiving end of this civil litigation. And yes, that is the former president. He has been charged civilly, as has his son and daughter as well, other members of his family, with violating, again, the civil law in New York State. They requested that the trial, which had been set to begin in October, just about 6 months or so from now, that trial be postponed well into 2024, next year. Probably because of the strategic notion that during 2024, the defendant, one of the defendants in this case, Donald Trump, is going to be actively involved, presumably, in the continuation of his campaign to retake the White House, his campaign, as he has announced it, for the presidency in 2024. Well, this past week, Judge Arthur Engoron, again, reviewing all this, taking into account the fact that this matter has been pending for a while, discovery continuing to be conducted, establishes some orders for the production of documents and the taking of depositions, all of that still going on in anticipation of the trial. Judge Engoron specifically says, no, I am not going to delay this trial any further. We've got a firm trial date. He says, on the record, come hell or high water, this case is going to trial. He said, yes, it's complex. It is complex, but it's not complicated to do. It's complex, but it's not complicated. A difference in those two things, according to the judge presiding over this matter. And so he rejects the request of the former president and his lawyers to postpone this trial. And so absent something extraordinary happening between now and October, there will be a civil trial, not a criminal trial, but a civil trial, again, advocated for, prosecuted by Letitia James in the New York State Court in front of a jury on these allegations of fraud related to properties, typically in Manhattan, but other places as well, alleging violations of state law with respect to the valuations of those properties and financial statements made about the condition, the status of the Trump organization. All of that presumably coming to trial now based upon the judge saying, no more delays. I'm going to go ahead and ensure that this case goes to trial. Again, all of that and other things out there on the docket of the former president, as we have talked about this morning on Morning Cannolis. Every single time we get together on Saturday mornings to talk about issues related to government, law, and the aspiration for justice in America, I cannot resist the temptation to talk with you more about what's happening in our Supreme Court. We have spent a lot of time on this broadcast answering your questions, responding to inquiries about why these cases are important, updating you on significant oral arguments of this, the 2022-2023 term, as our present Supreme Court takes up some 63 different matters. They've actually already issued some opinions in some of them, but likely the great majority of those opinions to be issued in May, in June, probably in July, perhaps as well. We're going to be spending a lot of time in the summer of this year talking about those decisions in major areas affecting our lives. We know about many of those cases. We have discussed them as well. Today, I want to talk with you about two matters that were also the subject of activity by our Supreme Court just this past week. We have mentioned one of them before, having to do with the Navajo Nation's water rights and its dispute, frankly, with the United States Department of Justice, having to do with the heritage of the Navajo tribe in our nation and its right to water rights in America. Before I get to that one, however, another matter that came up in the all-important area of privacy rights and, yes, abortion rights. Again, flew somewhat under the radar this past week. A case that is significant just because of all of the activity in the wake of the overturning of Roe versus Wade back in June of last year in Dobbs versus Reproductive Services. We know what happened at that time. An opinion issued by Justice Alito on behalf of a majority, not a unanimous court by any means, a 6-3 court finding that there is indeed not a privacy right to reproductive rights under our Constitution, overturning the 1973 decision in Roe issued by Justice Blackmun, a majority of the court finding at that time that indeed there was a privacy right, overturning about 49 years of precedent, reliance upon that, causing, of course, all of this to go back into states. We have seen in recent times not only activities in legislatures, legislating both in favor of abortion rights, privacy rights, but an awful lot of legislation as well related to restricting the right previously established by our Constitution under the auspices of the Supreme Court. Well, this past week, believe it or not, the Supreme Court undertook to review an abortion case coming out of Missouri. And again, it's unlikely that you've heard a lot about this because of the, I don't want to say insignificant nature of it, but because of the way in which it was disposed of, but once again highlighting the fact that abortion issues continue every single week in our nation to be on our collective docket, the appropriate focus legislatively, certainly in litigation around this country, arguably criminal litigation in some jurisdictions for those people who might enforce reproductive rights. What happened this past week in front of the United States Supreme Court and from members of the Supreme Court? It focuses on the most recently appointed member of our Supreme Court. Her name, of course, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. She dissented on Monday, just a few days ago, as the Supreme Court basically wiped out, set aside a federal appeals court ruling coming out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. They set aside a court ruling that had upheld the right of a minor in Missouri to go to court to obtain permission to seek an abortion without parental notification. That's a lot to consume. Let me go down that road once again. The federal appeals court, the Eighth Circuit, had upheld the right of this minor in Missouri to go to court to obtain a permission to seek an abortion without parental notification. The Supreme Court basically wiped that out based upon an action, a legal concept that we'll describe and talk to you about right after this break, also involving Ketanji Brown Jackson.
It's the Mad City Bridal Expo, Sunday, March 26th at the Monona Terrace in Madison. Imagine planning your wedding in just one day. Pre-register for tickets at madcitybridalexpo.com.
Kids, they're just different than us. They have no inhibitions, consider silverware optional, and can find fun anywhere. And when kids get really sick, they're different than us too. Until now, children diagnosed with blood cancer have been treated like many adults. Not anymore. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society proudly introduces the Dare to Dream Project, transforming treatment and care through advocacy, education, and the largest global clinical trial for kids with blood cancer. For the first time, a specific treatment can be matched to a specific type of cancer in a specific child. It'll be the biggest medical advancement for little patients in history. Dare to dream with us. Support the Dare to Dream Project and all the work that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does at LLS.org.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast. A mix of clouds and sun this afternoon, with daytime highs approaching 41. Winds out of the northwest, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Partly cloudy skies again tonight. Lows dip down to about 22. Highs around 39. Tomorrow, sunshine mixed with clouds at times. Sunshine mixed with clouds at times. Tuesday, with daytime highs approaching 42. 35, chance for snow Wednesday. A dusting of snow Tuesday night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Ray Miller. Right now, it's 34.
News and talk. Up, down, and all around the Fox Valley. This is Civic Media.
This is Morning Cannolis, talking right before the break about a modestly important case that was resolved by the Supreme Court just this past week in the abortion area. It comes about because a 17-year-old in Missouri had asked the court for permission to terminate a pregnancy of hers without notifying her parents, as was required by state law. The lower court's clerk told that girl that her parents would be notified despite her wishes. And after traveling to Illinois for the procedure, she sued. She went into court and she argued that her constitutional rights were trampled by that decision of the court. The state of Missouri argued that the district court judge should be immune from her lawsuit, but the Eighth Circuit, the federal circuit in that part of our country, sided with the challenger by the young woman. She is now an adult, and the Supreme Court on Monday vacated that ruling, although probably not for the reason why you might think. The Supreme Court decided that based upon the overturning of Roe versus Wade in Dobbs, that the matter is basically mooted, that there's no reason to do this anymore. And indeed, eight of the nine justices concur in that, in a matter that, again, has no real practical effect in Missouri. Missouri, as you probably know, is currently has one of the strictest abortion bans in the country. No exceptions for rape or incest. Procedure only permissible to save the pregnant person's life or prevent severe damage to their health. And of course, state restrictions on abortion rights of minors have long predated Dobbs, including in many blue states. Many abortion rights supporters view those laws as the proving ground for laws later expanded to apply to adults after the fall of Roe. Lots of things going on out there. What did Ketanji Brown Jackson do? Well, just this past week, again, she was the only Supreme Court justice who decided to dissent. And she said, this case presents absolutely no extraordinary circumstances that justify vacating the lower court's decision. And she said, in my view, it is crucial that we hold the line and limit the availability of what she called the Munsingware vacator to truly exceptional cases. So not only did she say that mere disagreement with the decision that one seeks to have vacated cannot suffice to justify what the court has done, but she introduces us once again to a civics concept, a legal concept called Munsingware vacator. And so in our last moments here, we're going to chat a little bit about that. What is vacator? V-A-C-A-T-U-R. Well, it comes from the Latin. It basically means it's vacated. It's set aside, a rule and order that is set aside because it's mooted. It's no longer relevant to go forward. There are other vacator laws in the area of sex trafficking. Those are different kinds of things. Vacator there means that we decriminalize the survivors of sex trafficking, not the kind of thing that is invoked here. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson invokes a case called Munsingware of a number of years ago, and that is the case in which a 1950 case having to do with the decisions by higher courts basically to find moot and therefore dismiss and get rid of lower court orders that have been mooted by other matters out there. And so Ketanji Brown Jackson this past week invokes that and says, I would not have found that the lower court's decision should be vacated. She, the only justice this past week to go down that road. Again, a case that is not going to have a huge impact upon our continuing debate in America about abortion rights, privacy rights, but nonetheless significant that the Supreme Court continues on this regular basis to address these kinds of issues, even in the wake of the overturning of Roe versus Wade in Dobbs, the case of last June. We do have a couple of callers in our last moments here. Let's get to them right now. Jake from Eureka, California. Jake, glad to have you with us this morning. Your comment or your question.
Hi, Jim. I'd like to ask you why the Democratic Party is continuing its weak and ineffectual response to Donald Trump's continuing calls for violence and other Republican politicians' continuing calls for civil war. You know, it's not just a threat at this point. It happened on January 6th. It's happened repeatedly with mass shootings by Trump supporters. I mean, we all recall the Walmart in New Mexico last July 4th, the pro-Trump rapper who went on a shooting spree. Donald Trump supporters are murdering folks. And why is it that even a call for self-defense on the part of Democrats would be seen as unacceptable when self-defense is perfectly legal in the United States?
You know, Jake, I frankly, I've got notes here, as I always do. And one of the things that I did not get to in our first segments was exactly the point you're making. Let's talk about what Donald Trump has said recently in social media, other places. We saw him just in the past couple of days holding a baseball bat above a picture of Alvin Bragg, again, who's the DA. Plainly making a threat to him. He talked about death and destruction, right? This is what you're chatting about, Jake, right? Talk about death and destruction in America, if indeed he is indicted by any of these various entities, federally, the state systems in Georgia, in New York, calling for protests, which, yes, is probably the least benign, offensive thing that he has done, arguably even benign. We certainly endorse protests, but we do not, to your good point, Jake, endorse or in any way approve of these kinds of things. He called Alvin Bragg an animal. He referred to him as a degenerate psychopath. All of that, to your point, I could not agree more. What does that do? Just as the president, former president, did on January 6th, it entices people, right? And it invites them. It encourages them, gives them sanction, if you will, to engage in violence. Could not agree more that everyone, Republicans, Democrats, everyone across the board, in office, outside of office, has got to say, not only is this an unacceptable behavior, it needs to be condemned. And again, whether Democrats, Jake, or Republicans, everybody should be looking at this and saying no. And it does. We know it does. Threats made against public officials like the one sent to Alvin Bragg this past week cannot be a part of our general understanding about how we do things in America, certainly contrary to the rule of law, should be the focus of condemnation across the board, Jake. So could not agree more. Ask that question, why we don't get more of this from all sides of the political aisle, responding to Donald Trump, even in the midst of no doubt pressure on him, does not give you the right, does not give you the prerogative to make threats that prompt people to engage in violence. Could not agree more, Jake. And thanks for the call. Thanks for always your good observations about these kinds of things. We have another guest also who's joined us. And all right, we don't. So that's fine. We'll go then to the final thing I wanted to chat about in our last moment or so. And that is another matter coming up before the Supreme Court just this past week. I'm going to chat about it more next time on our next show. But the Supreme Court this past Monday, again, also engaged in a lot of activity having to do with our Native American populations. On Monday, entertained argument about the rights of our Navajo Nation in our western states, and in particular, as you know, with states of Arizona, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico. The Navajo Nation, the reservation there, crosses borders in all of those states. There, the justices heard arguments on whether the Navajo lawsuit that they had brought in federal court, claiming the federal government has a duty to address the tribe's traditional heritage water rights, can move forward. Supreme Court entertaining oral argument on a case, we've chatted about this a little bit, appeared to be somewhat divided about whether or not the Native American tribe can go forward with this. A two-hour oral argument that happened, and again, we're going to chat more about this. Amy Coney Barrett may well be the deciding justice in this case. We're going to chat more about that. Other matters related to the Supreme Court in our convocation, our gathering next week on Morning Cannolis. Join us then. Her sex ways make a old man win.
wish for younger days, yeah, yeah.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.u.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app. AB.